Once again, welcome to Carry the Message, Not the Wreckage. Now, do you know what most people are afraid of? Well, I'm going to tell you right now. Most people are afraid of spiders and snakes. How many, raise your virtual hand if you're afraid of spiders and snakes.
I don't like spiders and snakes, and that ain't what it takes to love me. Like I wanna be loved by you.
Spiders and snakes. It's estimated. What the heck is Cameron talking about? Spiders and snakes. It is estimated that 33% of the world's population has some fear of spiders, which is arachnophobia, and snakes, which is ophidiophobia. And by the way, my son Victor, he's 42. I used to breed snakes when I was a younger man, and my son was exposed to all these weird reptiles and spiders and all kinds of crazy things. So he breeds currently tarantulas and scorpions. I have this cute little 20-month-old granddaughter who's just fascinated with bugs now. And people say, "Oh my God, what is Victor's wife think of all that?" Well, Victor's wife also breeds tarantulas and scorpions, so they found themselves a perfect match. So the question is, how do we overcome our fear of spiders and snakes? Well, we deliver a presentation on spiders and snakes. I throw the strategy of overcoming one's fear of spiders and snakes as a bonus to this presentation. Okay, so let's carry the message, not the wreckage. Each individual, and you know, I'm going to quote from the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous a lot because the big book gives us very specific instructions on how to deliver our story to our fellowships and to our audiences. And each individual in their personal stories describes in their own language and from their own point of view the way they establish their relationship with God. Or you can call that higher power or divine consciousness or whatever word you want to put to it. Now, we can only clear the ground a bit. So if our testimonies help sweep away prejudice. So every addict has a story. Every addict here has a story to share. And somewhere in the fellowship, there is an ear that needs to hear your story. They need to hear that. Because your story, your recovery story as an ex-problem addict is important, and it's vital to our fellowship. A good share will identify with those who struggle with addiction, and they in their turn will identify with you and come to that conclusion, hey, I'm like you, and you're like me, but you don't do it anymore, and I want what you have. Right? And we grab their attention. Our story has a depth and weight that's very compelling. And by sharing what happened and what we're like today, the newcomer comes to believe that there's hope that they too can escape their difficulty, and we win the newcomer's confidence. Now, one thing I've heard in a lot of stories, a lot of shares, is sometimes they'll drift into the problem. They'll drift into the worry, the remorse, the morbid reflection. And that diminishes our usefulness to others. We're already experts in the problem, right? It's the solution that we need to hear about and want to hear about. I don't need any more intel on the problem of my addiction. And so we must be careful not to drift into that realm a little bit to qualify that we, you know, we're in the right place, but not those, you know, drunkalogs, you know, those I've heard people in drunkalogs, war stories, junkie pride tales, even just rambling on in incoherent thoughts and the minutiae of one's life. And I, you know, I always know when I'm in for one of those long, boring talks, when the speaker opens up with, I remember my first drink. I was in my mother's third trimester, and I realized I didn't drink like the other fetuses. And I go, oh God, here we go, right? 45 minutes of a long-winded war story, right? And some speakers never know when to stop. Just when you think they're wrapping it up, they jump down another rabbit hole and go on for another 10, 15 minutes. And, you know, many times I've heard speakers do that and constantly digressing into another stream of consciousness, and they go on ad nauseum. So, you know, it's important to know when to wrap it up, because if you don't, you don't want to leave your audience with the feeling that you talk too much.
You talk too much, you worry me to death. You talk too much, you even worry my pet. You just talk, talk too much.
Now, at the end of this presentation, which is about 90 minutes, you'll be able to walk away from this presentation and have access to my notes and slides, as well as the audio version of this particular share. 10 strategies for overcoming the fear of speaking in front of an audience. 5 ways to conduct yourself when speaking virtually or in person. Identify 3 major benefits of speaking to a 12-step meeting or an event. List 3 key elements of a compelling story. Identify 3 ways to win the newcomer's confidence. Know the 3 essential components for a well-structured story. Learn 3 ways to dynamically open your share. 4 ways to identify and connect with your audience. 5 important ways to describe what happened, very important part of our story. Describe 3 ways to inspire others to work their program. And 3 approaches to dynamically close your talk. Now, just before I launch into it, this workshop is entirely voluntary. There are no dues or fees for this workshop, but we do take a 7th tradition. This is our QR code to our website, caservicesponsorship.org, and our 7th tradition. I know it takes a little more effort to give virtually, because you got to go to the site, you got to fill out a form, then the form redirects you to our PayPal account. And if you have PayPal, you got to log in. And if you don't have PayPal, then you fill out a form and you put your credit card. And, you know, it takes a lot more effort to donate in our 7th tradition. But if you like what we do here today and you find it valuable and it's worthy of preserving and seeing it continue, we try to do one once a quarter. We would appreciate your support, whether it be, you know, $5, $10, $20, whatever. It helps offset our Zoom costs. It helps offset our website costs. And of course, in a tongue-in-cheek way, the message of the 7th tradition is basically this.
Your love gives me such a thrill, but your love won't pay my bills. I want money.
So thank you for your generosity, and I'll call this screen up again at the end of the presentation. Okay, so a lot can happen when you go to the podium. Now, how many people here have seen the movie The Ghost and Mr. Chicken? Anyone seen The Ghost and Mr. Chicken? I'm really dating myself because I used to watch it as a boy back in the 60s. Came out in 1966, starring Don Knotts, who plays the central protagonist, Luther Higgs. And there's a scene in this movie where Luther has to make a presentation. He has to deliver a keynote to the locals at this city that are this town that he's involved with. And this is his talk. And everything that could go wrong with a share from the podium goes wrong for Luther here. So here's the clip.
Thank you, Mayor, and fellow Rachelinians. That electrician must be a Democrat. Thank you, Mayor and fellow Rachelinians. I'm proud to be here today.
Attaboy, Luther!
when I was asked to be guest speaker at this luncheon, I asked myself this. Who are you, Luther Higgs, to be a guest speaker at this luncheon? I thought about my answer about being guest speaker for a long time. Well, what is a guest speaker? Let me clarify this. I have been called brave. What is brave? Let me clarify this. Of course, we all know that it is short for bravery. That goes without even being said. But it is also a symbol of another thing. It is a symbol of doing one's duty, no matter what is scaring him personally.
Attaboy, Luther!
Take your World War II. There were many heroes in World War II. What were your heroes? Who were your heroes? Let me clarify this. Thank you for having me.
There's a lot of things going wrong in that particular share. And a lot of things can go wrong, unexpected things, even though you prepared for your talk and some unexpected things may happen. So, you know, as Luther Higgs demonstrated, he was awfully nervous being up there at the podium. Then there's technical issues. The mic is acting up. And then he tries to make a joke about the electrician and it bombs. And the room is dead silent. Then his notes blow away, lose the notes. And then you got hecklers in the audience, attaboy Luther, you know, just, you know, that can disrupt one's flow and thought. Now, the good news is no matter how good or how bad your share is, your audience is going to clap. They're going to clap for you at the end of your audience. At the end of your share, your audience will always acknowledge that you took the time to go to the podium. So that's the good news. Okay, so now glossophobia. This is known as the fear of public speaking, and it affects approximately 73% of the population. So how do we overcome our fear of public speaking? Now, this fear is more common than the fear of death, and it can significantly impact personal and professional lives. So the question I want to ask here, and I'm going to open it up for a bit of discussion, is what are we really afraid of when we're asked to do a share, when we're asked to go up to the podium and speak to an audience? And why do we have this fear? So I'm just going to stop sharing here for a minute and let's open it up. What are we really afraid of when we go up to the front of the room? What is it that scares the hell out of us that might happen? Candace?
I think it's the fear of being seen and making a mistake, which is, I think, rooted in a bit of fear of shame, because it's one thing if you make a mistake, but when you make a mistake and you're being seen, it's a whole new ball game.
Yeah. Yeah, no, everybody wants to do a good job. Even the audience wants you to do a good job. But sometimes, you know, things can go wonky. Thank you, Candace. Dana.
Dana, I was going to say judgment and criticism.
Yeah, judgment. What is the audience thinking of me up there, you know? Judging me, having all sorts of nasty thoughts. Right. Yeah, that can definitely happen. I remember speaking. I was asked to speak at a very large meeting of about 350 people. And as soon as they realized Cameron F. was the speaker, about 20 of them stood up in a very dramatic way and stormed out of the meeting. Whoa. So there's a bit of judgment. Right. Yeah, I get that. Thank you. Jeanette. Have to unmute yourself, dear. You got it? Jeanette's having trouble unmuting. It's the ability to use a computer, Jeanette, that separates us from being toilet trained apes. Go ahead, Jeanette.
Are you asking me, Jeanette, or is there another Jeanette here?
Jeanette, is that right?
Me?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. Some of the fears that I'll freeze and go into a drunk log, but not necessarily. Just the not carrying the message, not expressing really what this message is about.
Right. Yeah. Freezing. Have you ever done that? You just go up the podium or you're about to say something, you go mentally blank. And then there's that pause that seems to never end, that silence. That's definitely a fear and things that can happen. Thank you. Mama Bear.
Fear of personal rejection, even though most of these people don't know who you are. I think that's a fear. Also throwing up in front of a lot of people, nerves, you know, nervousness. Rejection.
Yeah, rejection's a big one. You know, I think most addicts suffer the fear of rejection at some level, and you know, and it will happen. There, you know, not everyone's going to love you. Some people actually, you know, dislike you and maybe even vilify you. I've experienced it all. But as you learn to deal with it, which is what we're going to do here today, it, you know, being at front of the podium can be a lot of fun, and not so. These fears are not insurmountable. Moshi, come on in.
Hi. Thanks, Cameron. I think one of the big differences between speaking and speaking in public is scrutiny. The minute you speak in public, people are looking and they're evaluating. We're just talking here. There's no one actually evaluating you. And that fear of their evaluation and what they'll say about your performance is a big fear, I think.
Yeah, and you know, I sometimes think this is a fear of mine because I've done it myself. I was an awful speaker. What a load of crap. That guy was full of shit, you know. And you know, it's kind of like if I see it within myself and then I, you know, project it on my audience is doing the same sort of thing. So yeah, that's
your self scrutiny and scrutiny of others. Interesting. Thank you.
Thank you, Moshi. Terry, Terry W. from HI, come on in.
Yeah, good evening. Yeah, so HI is actually hospitals and institutions. Sorry, but it's relevant, really. So obviously, if someone's doing a riddle with fear, yeah, so every time there's a fear underneath it, isn't there? Like fear of not being good enough, fear of people's opinions, fear of rejection. But I think what sometimes doesn't get mentioned is the environment. So, you know, for members of Cocaine Anonymous, if they're going to do a share, most people have not been in an institution. So there's an added fear of the environment. So it could be the environment that the person's going to share in. Because obviously, if we're doing shares in prisons, rehabs, things like that, you know, there's specific different types of sharing, different guidelines. But a lot of people disqualify themselves because they've never been to prison, you know, and we've all been to prison, the prison of our mind. So sometimes that disqualifies people. So environment can be a factor.
You know, I never thought of that. That's a really interesting perspective. Because, you know, now I've spoken in prisons and yeah, it can be a little intimidating, you know, seeing 300-400 orange jumpsuits in the audience all staring back at you. You know, sometimes people like, now I personally love a big room. Like I would love to do World AA, 55,000 dickweeds in the audience. I could really get into that. But some people are very intimidated by the size of an audience, you know, or the nature of the venue. So yeah, I can appreciate the environment being somewhat intimidating, you know. And so it usually boils down every time I've done this workshop, the common fears, the fear of failing in front of the audience or looking incompetent, making mistakes, going blank, forgetting what we were about to talk about, not being worthy enough. And now what I'll add to the list are the intimidation of the environment itself being at the front of the room. So the question is now, like, what can we do about it? How can we surmount these potential obstacles to delivering an effective talk, as opposed to being shut down by that? And so we're going to continue on here. So 10 strategies for overcoming the fear of public speaking. So number one thing is structure your presentation. You want to avoid stream of consciousness sharing. And I see a lot of this at the podium. In fact, it's almost like, people think, oh, if you're planning your talk or whatever, I don't know how, they go to the mic and they say, I don't know what I'm going to talk about. They'll do a prayer right there at the mic, and whatever comes in to their mind, they'll deliver. Now, there's good news and bad news about that approach. So when it comes to the fear of public speaking, 90% of glossophobia is caused, it's triggered with public speakers because of poor preparation and lack of awareness about the methods to manage it while you're at the podium. So many times I've heard speakers go to the podium, they don't know what they're going to share, the stream of consciousness comes out. Now, the problem is sometimes the speaker will deliver an amazing presentation in the stream of consciousness. The problem is because it's stream of consciousness, they really don't remember what they said. So it's very hard to duplicate those key messages the next time you have an opportunity to share. And just as conversely, the share may go over really badly and nobody likes it, but you have no idea what it was you said or how you delivered it that created that outcome. And once again, you run the potential of duplicating it again at another share. So you, the way to overcome it is to structure your presentation. Write your presentation down, make notes, arrange your key messages so that you can deliver the message you need to deliver to the audience and have that audience go, hey, I'm like you, you're like me, don't do it anymore, and I want what you have. So we want to write down our presentation and use your own words. And two caveats: avoid jargon and avoid vulgar language. Here in Toronto, we have a group of big book thumpers known as the Muckers. And there's a passage in our big book where we separate the different types of drinkers or user, the moderate drinker, the moderate user. They can take it or leave it alone. Then there's the heavy drinker, the heavy user. But this person, given sufficient reason, like falling in love, warning of a doctor, change of environment, being institutionalized, they too can either stop, curtail, or manage their addiction patterns. But what about the real alcoholic? What about the real addict? Now, they refer to these three classes of drinking and using as type ones, type two, type threes. Type one being the moderate, type two being the heavy user, and type three being the real addict. Well, the problem with jargon is unless your audience is in on the jargon, they haven't got a clue what you're talking about. So there'll be a disconnect. So if you're going to use jargon, you can use jargon, but define your terms when you're sharing. You want your audience in on what it means, right? And you want to avoid vulgar language. I remember I went to a meeting. It was called the Golden Mile Group here in Toronto. And I opened my share with four things that were really, well, I'll just share it with you. I got to the podium and said, hi, my name's Cameron. And physically, I'm fucked. Emotionally, I'm fucked. Mentally, I'm fucked. And spiritually, I'm fucked. My name's Cameron, and I'm a member of a 12-step fellowship. And it was, and at the end of this share, and I used a lot of vulgar language, and it was one of my first shares. This woman came up and she says, Cameron, you have a really good message, but you have a filthy, filthy mouth. And as she walked away, I got to thinking that's all she's going to remember about me was how filthy and vulgar my mouth was, and missed or did not remember the important message that I was trying to convey. So jargon and vulgar language, I have learned through hard experience, can be an impediment to your audience hearing your story and hearing the value of what it is that you're trying to deliver. You know, the great thing about when you're aware of what you're doing, I once used a joke because I'm a bourbon drinker. I drank bourbon every day, and I made this. I was trying to make a joke, and this is where jokes can bomb. And I said they should market bourbon like cigarettes. You know, you pick up a pack of cigarettes. There's black lungs on it, diseases and all that, and it's really offensive to look at. You know, why would I smoke this? Well, I said they should market bourbon along the same way. They should have a picture of a woman on the bottle with a black eye. And nobody in the audience laughed. It went over like a lead balloon, and I got a direct hit that analogy was too close to home. Both those who made it perpetuated the domestic violence and those that were on the receiving end. So it behooves you to be very cognizant of what it is you're saying and doing, so you can adjust your talk accordingly and continue to improve, and because you want your audience to hear your message. You don't want them to remember. Oh, I remember that awful joke Cameron told. That was just awful. And lastly, you want to rehearse your presentation. You want to practice it. Some people accuse me, oh, you're that guy that stands in front of the mirror and practice your presentation. I really don't stand in front of the mirror, but I do go over in my mind what key messages I want to share and the sequence in which I share them in. So you want to know your key messages, but you don't want to memorize your talk. Avoid going down that path. Because sometimes with memory, you'll be doing your, it's almost like a stream of consciousness. You'll be delivering what you remember, and then all of a sudden you hit a mental blank spot and you can't remember what you're going to say next. And then you're all discombobulated. You don't want to do that. So know your key messages, but you don't need to memorize your presentation. Before speaking, take time for prayer and meditation. You know, when I go to speak, especially in person, and I've got, you know, a somewhat of a large audience, I'm all wound up. I get keyed up. I'm very, you know, there's a lot of energy. I'm gearing up. I'm sharpening my focus to deliver to my presentation. But I want to go to the podium in a centered manner. So I'll take time out. You know, I usually go to the bathroom, center my body. I do a prayer. I do a meditation. I ask God to demonstrate through me what God can do, and ask God to remove any fears or intrepidation and direct my attention to how God would have me be at the podium. And oddly enough, it tends to alleviate any kind of angst or you know, qualms or butterflies in my stomach. And I've come to really enjoy going to the front of the room. I have a lot of fun in front of the room because I know my presentation. I've prayed and meditated and centered myself. And, you know, and visualize your performances with old visualization, you know, actualization techniques, but visualize your performance, build it clearly in your mind, see yourself in a successful outcome, delivering the message as you want to deliver them. And you'll be amazed at how that actually manifests when you deliver your talk. When speaking, focus on your audience. Most importantly, focus on carrying the message to the newcomer. So, you know, I focus my thoughts. When I focus my thoughts on Cameron, when I focus my thoughts on me as to how good do I look? How good am I sharing? You know, how does my audience perceive me? I inevitably become nervous and I make mistakes, forgetting my train of thought, and I get flustered because I'm focused on Cameron rather than my audience. So what I do instead now, when I go to the front of the room, my focus is on the newcomer in the audience. Who needs to hear my story? Remembering everything we do in our fellowship, no matter how grandiose it gets, or the pomp and circumstance at the group level or the area level, the, you know, the world level, everything we do in our fellowship, regardless of the fellowship you're involved with, is designed to fulfill the primary purpose of Tradition 5, to carry the message to the addict that still suffers. That's why I'm there. Everything I do is to fulfill that purpose. So I focus on the newcomer. Now, another thing you can do, which is a great technique, if the group or the event that's having you speak isn't recording you, record yourself. Take your smartphone up to the podium with you, put it on the voice recorder and record yourself speaking. And then you want to listen to it afterwards and make notes and revise your share accordingly. What worked, what didn't work. And I remember someone saying to me, what speakers do you listen to, Cameron? I go, I listen to me. What? Yeah, Cameron F. He's my favorite speaker. I listen to him all the time. I listen to this guy. This guy's brilliant. Some people just don't get the humor. But listen to yourself. It's very informative to hear yourself feed back to you the talk that you gave. So record yourself. Now, I remember my first share. It was way back in 2008. It was for a small group, a couple cities away from me here in Toronto. And I went and I recorded myself. Now, I'd done all the things that I've just discussed. I prepared my talk. I knew my key messages. I knew the order of which I wanted to deliver. And I delivered my talk, but I recorded it. Actually, I recorded it back then on those pocket recorders just before smartphones were so prevalent. And it was a good share. It turned out really good. So at the time, the speaker hub of all MP3, digital MP3, digital speaker shares was on this Icelandic hub called xaspeakers.org. So I called them up and I said, I just heard the most incredible speaker. You got to get this guy on your platform. And they said, well, send us his MP3 and we'll publish it. So I fired off my MP3 recording. They published it on their website, and some 20,000 downloads later, I've been invited all over the world. Now, I gotta admit, it was a little bit of promotion, but another value to recording yourself. You just may deliver one kick-ass talk. And we want to preserve it, and we want it out there in the fellowship so we can inspire others to do our program and find recovery and end their suffering. And the last three strategies, remember, you'll never have a more accepting and forgiving audience. The fear of judgment, the fear of being, ridiculed, it's fake news. Most fears are fake news. Your audience wants you to do well. They want you to look good. They want to hear a good talk. They're rooting for you. That's why they clap, and they will clap whether it's bad or good. They're a forgiving audience. They accept you. We're one of them. We're one of each other, right? We're all in this together. So remember, you'll never have a more accepting and forgiving audience when you're at the front of the room. Share from the I perspective. Avoid using you language. Now, I use I and we. I'll talk about I did this, I did that. We are like this, we are like that to be inclusive. I don't use the you language because when I use you language, you need to do this and you need to do that and you are this and you are that. It gets very self-righteous and it gets preachy. And I don't think any addict likes to be preached to, but when you stick to the I perspective, and they may disagree with you. Well, I don't agree with that at all. How dare you judge me? How dare you take my inventory? But when you speak from the I perspective, it's yours. You own it. It's your experience. No one can take that away from you because it's your experience. So I recommend when you share from the I perspective. And lastly, of course, have a lot of fun. It's meant to be fun at the front of the room, right? Dare to be outrageously yourself. Most people will not. Most people restrain who they are, constrain it, stifle it. Dare to be outrageously yourself. Let that magic, let that wonderful, unique aspect of yourself flow from you to your audience. Because what'll happen is, and if you've ever been to a stage performance with actors or a concert, and the performers are giving it all they got, they're being outrageously who they are, and they create an energy, and you connect with that energy, and it's powerful. Like you really resonate with the performer. Well, as the audience is connecting with the performer, the performer is feeling that connection too. And there's an energy that's created when you get that magic. Now, you don't get it every time, but when you do get it, man, that's magic. It's dope. It's really a cool experience when you get that connection. So have fun. Dare to be outrageously yourself. Okay, five ways to conduct yourself when speaking virtually or in person. Now, they're similar in some respects, but they are two different mediums in which we carry the message. So, with virtual meetings, before presenting, take a look at yourself in the mirror and on camera. Like before this meeting started, I logged in, I looked at how I was coming across on the camera. You want to make sure you have your up and close personal face on. You know, with women, you know, you might make attention to your makeup and your hair, you know, and all that sort of stuff. You want to present a deportment, right? There's a deportment. And if you really want to cheat, there's a setting on Zoom where you can soften the look of your face. My wife has hers set fairly high because we're both 69 years old and she's a presenter. So she fiddles with that Zoom setting that softens the, you know, it's like airbrushing your face using the camera. So you get, there's lots of things you can do, but you want to present a nice, appealing look. You want to sit comfortably in your chair when you're presenting virtually. You don't want to be standing or moving around. And I make eye contact when I'm presenting to a grid of people. You know, some people have their cameras on, some people have them off, but I'll look for someone who is engaged with me. They're laughing, they're smiling, they're acknowledging, they're hearing me. I will focus on that person when I'm speaking virtually, and I get a connection going. I don't know whether they get a connection going with me. Sometimes I'll even actually call them out by name, just say, "Hey, I see you," right? So, you know, these are some of the benefits we have when speaking virtually. I use a laptop or a desktop computer rather than my phone. Occasionally, I've done a share on the phone because I'm not at home in my office, but I prefer the laptop. I have a bigger screen. I can manage my Zoom settings a lot better that way. I also want to be cognizant that my camera's at the right angle. You're not seeing the bald spot on the top of my head, or you're not looking up my nostrils, you know, because the camera's, you know, misaligned, right? So you want to see how you're coming across in front of your audience. Watch the facial expressions on your audience grid. As I said, are they engaged? Are they smiling? Are they laughing? Are they nodding their heads? And when you do speak, you know, smile, speak clearly, modulate your tempo for emphasis, and be dynamic. One of the most common things I hear when I get feedback is my level of enthusiasm. I like to be very enthusiastic when I present. Actually, enthusiasm is one of the most contagious things you can demonstrate. There's only one thing more contagious than enthusiasm. You know what it is? A lack of it. That's the only thing more contagious than enthusiasm, the lack of enthusiasm. And I've been in some rooms where there's no enthusiasm. So that's how we present, how I recommend you present when you're speaking virtually on Zoom. Now, if you have the benefit of going to an in-person live meeting, well, you want to be sure that you're well groomed, you know, be well groomed, you know, dress appropriately. Now, lately, I used to do the 12 steps, 4 hours workshop on New Year's Eve, and I'd wear a tuxedo. Well, as I got to seeing myself on the screen, I thought, you know, I look really good in a tux. So I wear a tux every day. I come down in the morning and my wife looks at me and go, "What the heck are you all dressed up for?" Well, this is my new look. I'm dressing in a tux every day. And by the way, my pronouns are shaken, not stirred. So, you know, I want to present someone who's well groomed and dress appropriately. I show that I care about my audience. When you go to the podium in an in-person meeting, stand in one place. Don't move back and forth. I was watching Sophie Cunningham because I watched the women's national basketball for, you know, I watched Sophie and I watched Caitlin Clark. Oh my God, those two young women are absolutely incredible. And I read Sophie was doing a talk in front of the camera, but she was swaying back and forth and moving, and it was very distracting. Both my wife and I commented on that it would come across, powerful as she is, even more powerful if she kind of like stood her ground. And presented from that standpoint. So plant your feet firmly. You know, one thing about a podium is you can grab the podium and hold on. Make eye contact with someone in the audience. When I speak personally in person, I'll look at someone in the audience, make eye contact, and speak to them directly. And then I'll move on to another person and I'll speak to someone at the back or someone in the front or someone on the left or someone on the right. And I keep moving around the audience, making eye contact. Now, if there's no mic, sometimes you'll go to an in-person meeting, they don't have a mic at the podium. You just got to be able to project your voice. And I've heard some speakers go to the podium and they speak so softly that you can't hear them. And you're thinking, what? What? Could you speak louder? Speak louder. You know, you don't want your audience doing that. So when if there's no mic to assist me in projecting my voice, I talk to the person in the back of the room. I project my voice so that that person in the back of the room can hear me. So my take-home message is stay loud and say it proud. Four, take note of your audience's engagement, just like on the Zoom. Are they engaged? Are they smiling? Are they laughing? Are they nodding their heads? And remember to smile, speak clearly, and modulate your tempo for emphasis and be dynamic. And by the way, with virtual meetings, you have the benefit of cheat notes. You can take notes to the podium too. And that's okay. Take your notes to the podium. You don't want to sit there and read from your notes, but you can take your notes with you if you want as kind of a safety net. And on virtual meetings, like you have your cheat notes right in front of you. No one even needs to see it. I'll let you in a little secret. I have my notes on each slide here in front of me as a backup in case I miss something that I want to communicate to the audience here. So there are little tricks that we can do to, you know, just allow us to deliver our message in the way that we want to deliver it. Three benefits of speaking. Now, number one, it fulfills tradition five. Our primary purpose is to carry the message. What's the message? Well, if you read it in the big book of AA, the 12 step, carry this message being the message of 12 steps as a recipe, very adeptly described in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. To carry our message of our hope, our faith, our courage, our experience, strength, and hope to the alcoholic or the addict, and all addicts are included in this, who still suffer, right? Because our new job description, which is delivered to us in step three, is to be of maximum service to God and our fellow human beings. And meetings should always be about the solution. They are a pep rally for the spiritual way of life. You know, so often I go into a meeting and they're, oh my God, the morbid reflection and the problems, and it's like depressing. By the end of the meeting, I'm a psychological casualty. I'm ready to put a bullet in my brain, or worse yet, a bullet in your brain. And now I need a meeting to fix the meeting I was supposed to hear an important message at. And so we want to be a pep rally. Hey, there's a way out. So every newcomer that comes that is suffering will leave that meeting with the hope and the faith and the courage that they are going to get a way out. They're going to find a way out of that hole they find themselves into. Let's communicate that there is a solution. Now, another benefit of speaking is it reinforces our identity as members of a 12-step program. One of the things I did in my early recovery, there's a line in the big book that says, go out and see what other religious people are doing. So I, being an addict, I said, well, I should go get a degree at the University of Toronto in medical anthropology and religions. Medical anthropology being the study of humans and their healing systems and religions. I concentrated on early Christian history, which allowed me to dovetail into Judaic and Islamic studies. And I also studied Hinduism because it was just such a radically different approach to religion and spirituality. Now, when I was at university, I was writing a paper on 12 steps. And one of my professors had done a longitudinal study in Food Addicts Anonymous. And she studied the recovery genres. Now, like in most fellowships, you have two genres of recovery. You have the recovered addict versus the recovering addict. Now, I'm sure you've all heard some people say, hi, my name is, and I'm a recovered addict. Or some people say, hi, my name is, and I'm a recovering addict. And they're two very different perspectives. Now, recovery stories are consequential for a person's experience of recovery. Because what we're doing in our identification and our storytelling, by telling and retelling, we're reinforcing our identity as members. And what she found in this longitudinal study, that those that identified as recovered addicts, the recovered narrative with its clear beginning, its turning points, and its favorable results was very much critical for stable and consistent recovery. What she found was those that identified as recovered addicts showed consistent abstinency. And that narration articulates and facilitates the members' constant affiliation and appropriation of these 12-step master narratives that we learned from our big book. So how you identify can have a bearing on your success as an addict. And I want to be able to carry that message to those in the audience to, in lack of a better word, enroll them into the identity of what it means to be a 12-step member. Now, just as conversely, this professor had found in this study that telling and retelling of an ambiguous, always recovering narrative, I'm always an arm's length away from the next drink or the next drug or the next thought or act that's going to lead me on a spree, in which the addict questions the received spiritual principle. They ponder hypothetical life paths, not actually pursued. They kind of keep a lazy foot in the program life and a cocky foot in the old life, and they end up, pissing all over their recovery. And she found with those that identified as recovering addicts could not maintain consistent abstinency. So how you identify, how you construct your identity as a presenter of a 12-step narrative to your audience has a bearing, an actual real bearing on the efficacy of your program. So in studying this, I learned that what is central to a 12-step recovery culture, because we're involved in a culture, 12 steps is a specific aspect of culture, is the personal story of the recovered addict. Our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, what we're like now. And a member's personal story reinforces this figured world of 12-step recovery. The narratives maintain the boundaries that structure and empower the 12-step recovery culture. By sharing our personal stories of what we used to be like, members identify as addicts. Our war stories convey important criteria for potential members to identify and label themselves as addicts. Hey, I'm like you, you're like me, right? And what we furthermore found that the personal testimonies are significant to the newcomers. Our stories of recovery are very significant to the newcomer because what it does is that it objectifies the central cultural elements of our 12-step world, such as the importance of attending meetings, getting a sponsor, helping other suffering addicts, doing service work for your 12-step group. And by listening to these narratives of recovered members, newcomers learn the culture of 12-step recovery. The newcomer learns the model of the 12-step testimonial by listening to other members through telling their own story. The newcomer comes to understand their own life as a member of a 12-step program. And this 12-step language, this rhetorical language, provides an attractive element that connects the newcomer to the 12-step culture and assures them that their drinking, their using, their acting out problem can be solved, resulting in behavioral transformation of newcomers, profound alterations in their reaction to life. Now, I know that's kind of a thick description of the benefits of speaking, but it's really, really important. And this is the scientific underpinning of how important how we construct our messages and how we identify and convey that important message to those that suffer plays not only a bearing on this recovery, but a bearing on our own. The third benefit of speaking is Bill W. suddenly realized in order to save himself, he must carry his message to another alcoholic or addict. It is important for the newcomer to realize that our attempt to pass this, our message of experience, strength, and hope, onto them plays a vital part in their recovery. They are actually helping us more than we're helping them. It's a bit of a ripoff, kind of being the prospect. But the newcomers, every time I've gone through it, I've learned something new about the program. I've learned something new about newcomers. I've learned something new about myself. It just keeps giving. The newcomers teach me a lot about me and my program. So every time I carry the message of suffering addict, I learn something new about myself, the newcomer, and the program. That's the third benefit. Now, what are the key elements for a compelling story? And once again, our big book gives us very clear directions on how to do this. Number one is structure. Our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we are like now. And these are the clearly delineated boundaries, you know, between the old self and the new self. And our stories in the second point is the message which can interest and hold these addicted people must have depth and weight. What's the depth and weight of our story? What's the one common universal element to all of us that binds all of us together, whether we're alcoholics, drug addicts, sex addicts, food addicts, cutters, codependents, gamblers, whatever the addiction pattern may be? What's the one thing we'd all love to be able to do that we can't do? And that thread is lack of control. I have no control. I have no control to stay stopped. And once I pick up or act out, I have no control of what that's going to look like, how long it's going to last, or how much I'm going to do, right? Because if any one of us can control what we love to do, would you be listening to this dickweed share for the, you know, 90 minutes online? I don't think so. We'd be out doing what we love to do, but we can't. That's the message. Hey, I'm like you. You're like me. I have no control. I'm just as powerless, and my life is just as unmanageable as yours, but you don't do it anymore. And I can't stop. That's very compelling to the newcomer. And then the outcome, we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that the newcomer will be persuaded to say, yes, I'm one of you guys. I'm one of them too, and I must have this thing. So when carrying our message, we want to remember to carry the message, not the wreckage. And you want to avoid drunkalogs and junkie pride stories. Like I often say when I hear a war story is, I already know how to drink, use, and act out. I don't need any more intel on that. I need enough to qualify that, hey, you've earned the right to speak to us, that you're one of us, but I don't need to belabor the point with all the drinking stories and all the using stories. And you want to avoid turning your share or a meeting into an Oprah wine fest or what I call open disgusting meetings or group therapy without a therapist, you know? And so, and the junkie pride stories, I've heard some speakers at the front bragging about how bad they were, about their awful lives. That's not really the message I want to carry. That's not the central message of my story. But I've heard speakers actually do that. So I avoid drunkalogs and junkie pride stories. Three ways to win the newcomer's confidence. And again, it's outlined in our big book very clearly that the ex-problem drinker, that's number one. You're an ex-problem drinker, an ex-problem user, an ex-problem addict. That's very compelling to someone who's just like you but can't be an ex. They're still active in their addiction, and you're not. That we have a solution. I got a way out. I got a way out of this problem for you, and I'm willing to share it with you. And number three is we're properly armed with the facts about ourselves. We know what it's like to live in that inescapable hole, but we have a way out. And my deportment shouts at you that I'm an ex-problematic, and I want to share it with you. I want to help you get out too. And we can generally win the confidence of another addict in a few hours. But until this understanding is reached, little or nothing can be accomplished. Because when we take the newcomer through the journey of the 12 steps, we're going to ask them to do some pretty wild things. I always love it when you hear no major decisions for the first year of recovery. Now, the first step says, I admit I'm powerless and my life is unmanageable. That's a pretty big decision to come to. Come to believe in a power greater than myself is going to restore me to sanity. That sounds like a major decision. Made a decision to turn my life and my will over to the care of God as I understand it. Big decision. A fearless and moral inventory. Big. Every one of our steps is a major decision. Oh, my God. No major decisions for the first year. So incredibly insane out there. Three types of shares. One of the most common shares you'll do is when we just go around the room and introduce ourselves. It's a short, less than 1 minute share. Number two is qualifying. Sometimes when you're asked to be like a group chair or you're chairing the meeting, you'll be asked to identify. This is a 3 minute or less presentation. Another type of share. And then, of course, there's the share where you're the main speaker, where you're sharing your hope, faith, and courage, or your experience, strength, and hope. You may get 15 minutes, 20 minutes, 30 minutes, 40 minutes, or even up to an hour, depending on the group that's asking you to share. So introducing ourselves. When sharing at a meeting, how should we introduce ourselves? Now, I've lined out my name as Cameron, and I'm a recovering addict. I do not identify in that manner. Sometimes I'll say, hi, my name's Cameron, I'm an addict. I don't like that because when I share that, hi, I'm Cameron, I'm an addict. Now, that's an important part of my story. And if you're a newcomer wondering you're in the right room and everyone's going, hi, I'm an addict, I'm an addict, I'm an addict, they begin to realize, yeah, I'm in the right room. But this share, and remember, I'm going to the meeting for two reasons. I go to the meeting for camaraderie, people like yourself, where we're all working to be helpful to one another and to the newcomer, and to carry a message to those that suffer. So when I share, I'm just an addict. All I'm presenting is a problem. The way I do share, and I opened this workshop with the sheriff, my name is Cameron. I'm an alcoholic addict who doesn't drink or use. Now, I do that deliberately because I'm conveying, I'm trying to win the confidence of newcomers. I'm an ex-problem addict. Yes, I'm one of you. I am an addict, but I'm an addict who doesn't use, which conveys the solution. And you don't hear that a lot in the room. So it kind of is like a pattern interrupt. People go, what did he say? An alcoholic addict doesn't drink or use? It sounds different, right? And because I'm doing it deliberately, I'm baiting the audience. I'm trying to find who in the audience wants to resonate. Hey, I think I want what he's got. My name is Cameron. I'm a recovered addict. Now, I will identify this way if I have the opportunity to explain. So in a minute or less, I say, hi, my name's Cameron. I'm a recovered addict. By recovered, I mean I have been shown through the 12-step program how to cleave to a higher power, a power far greater than the god of alcohol, greater than the god of cocaine, greater than the god of sex, greater than the god of food, greater than the god of gambling. And by cleaving to this power, I can easily control my desire to drink, use, or act out, and hence recover from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. That's like 40 seconds, right? My name is Cameron. I'm a member of Cocaine Anonymous. I sometimes identify that way. I'm a member of this 12-step fellowship. And it actually, that line is right out of the big book. As I said, I'm an alcoholic addict, doesn't drink or use or act out. My name is Cameron. I'm an addict who knows how to stop. That's another way of saying it. And if I'm having fun with an audience, like if I'm in an old stodgy AA meeting with a lot of blue hairs, and I open up with, hi, my name's Cameron. I'm an agent, a spearhead of God's ever advancing creation. Oh man, they get wound up with that. Who do you think he is? That sounds like a lot of ego. But you know, it's right out of the big book, page 49. Are we not intelligent agents? Spearheads of God's ever advancing creation? I thought, yeah, that's what I want to be. And so you can have fun with this little introduction as you go around the room, and it's your chance to introduce. Stand out, say it loud, say it proud. You know, reach out. Remember, you're talking to the newcomer. Qualifying as an addict. What qualifies you to share a message? What are the facts about yourself? What can you say in 3 minutes or less that will persuade those in the meeting to say, yes, I'm like you and you're like me, but you don't do it anymore? And so this is your 3 minute talk. This is what we call the elevator talk. You're on the elevator, you're going down, you're going up, and you're sharing with someone in the elevator. You got about 3 minutes to do it. So an example of that, hi, my name's Cameron. I'm an alcoholic addict who doesn't drink or use. What I was like as an alcoholic addict is I worshiped the god of alcohol and the god of cocaine for 26 years, morning, noon, and night. And in the beginning, it was a lot of fun. In the middle, it got fun with problems. And then in the end, it was horrifying. I could not stop. Once I started, I had no idea how long I was going to drink or use for. And every time after a debacle, I'd come up for air and I'd say, I don't want to do this anymore. I don't want to do this anymore, filled with horror and remorse. And then I'd make a firm resolution not to do it again, only to succumb to desire again. Why? Because I got a liar that lives in my head that thinks somehow, some way, I'm going to be able to control and enjoy my next drink or my next drug. And here's the problem. The liar always wins the argument. And the conclusion is, I will drink and I will use again. Nothing human, secular, or psychological is going to stop this train wreck from happening. And this is a horrifying conclusion. Yet as a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, as a member of Cocaine Anonymous, it's been 22 years since I've had any desire to drink, use, or act out. Because I met someone armed with the facts about themselves, a common solution, and were ex-problem addicts, and they showed me a way out. And my life has changed dramatically, a profound alteration in my reaction to life of being shown how to cleave to a power that lets me easily control my desire to drink, use, or act out. And hence, I've rebuilt a marriage. My wife and I celebrate 36 years of marriage this year. I have the love and trust of my 40-year-old daughter and 42-year-old son. My liver went back to normal after 6 years. I went back to university, graduated at the top of my class in medical anthropology and religion. And I travel all over the world speaking to CA and AA. I've been to Spain, Denmark, all across England, United States, Canada. It is a stellar life being a member of this wonderful thing called the 12-Step Fellowship. That's a three-minute qualification share. A lot of information was imparted in that three-minute chat. So you want to think about, what is your three-minute elevator talk? And then, of course, there's your main speaker share, which is structured into five elements. There's your opening, where you introduce yourself. There's the share what you used to be like. This is where you tell an effective war story and win the newcomer's confidence. I always kind of affectionately refer to this. This is your jaywalker story. Share what happened. Share how you hit bottom, how you reached that turning point, how you found that jumping off place, that moment of clarity of how you found and worked a 12-step solution. Share what you're like today. This is your bragging rights. Talk about the promises fulfilled, how life has taken on a new meaning, how we have found the fellowship that we crave. And then closing your talk with a signature sign-off, something that uniquely defines you at the end of your share. So opening your share, introduce yourself. Now, you can do this in a number of ways. You can introduce yourself, just a short, hey, my name's Cameron. I'm an alcoholic addict who doesn't drink or use. That's kind of a paradox, because if you think about step one, the conclusion is that I will drink and use again, yet I don't. How is that possible? You could tell a humorous analogy or short story. You know, I have a couple of different analogies that I use. Like I open with, I like to ask people, are you working a program? And they often say, oh, yeah, I'm working a program. I go to a meeting every day, sometimes three meetings a day. Meeting makers make it 90 and 90. And I go, no, that's not what I'm talking about. Are you working with working with someone? Oh, yeah, I got a sponsor. Call them every day. Don't make a decision till I talk to my sponsor. My sponsor tells me who I can sleep with, how to manage my money. I don't make a decision until I talk to my sponsor. No, that's not what I'm talking about. Are you working with a newcomer? Newcomer, I've only been in this program 2 years. I'm still a newcomer. This is a selfish program. I got to work on me first, and I never see them again. That's one way I might open up with an analogy or a short story. I have another one where I talk about the addict down in the hole. The friends and family try to help them, but they can't seem to get them out of the hole. The religious community comes along with their scripture and their faith without works program, but they can't seem to get the addict out of the hole. The medical community with their Suboxone and methadone and clorazepam and diazepam and perazepam, they don't seem to be able to get the addict out of the hole. And then the treatment center industry with their 1% success rates and their how do you feel, you know, open sharing, a problem shared is a problem have, can't seem to get the addict out of the hole. Now, I got good news and bad news. The good news is there is a way out of the hole. The bad news is you're probably too selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and frightened to do the work, and you're going to die. And in the 22 years of working with others, I buried 50 people, 38 overdoses, mostly to alcohol death. Alcohol and benzos are the two most dangerous things you can be addicted to. You got to be very careful detoxing from those substances. 10 people committed suicide in sobriety, could not, would not live our way of life, got stuck, can't live with it, don't know how to live without it, took their own lives, and two were murdered. So those are kind of some of the short stories that I may share. Lots of different quotes in the big book. You can open up your share with a quote, you know, like the step 12 quote. If you're carrying a message to be helpful to the newcomer, practical experience shows that nothing ensures immunity. A gain from drinking or using or acting out is intensive work with other addicts. It works when all other activities fail. There's another big book quote, guy by the name of Richard E., who started the Richmond Groups. And Richard, what a character, what an outrageously individual man this is. And he says, the shortest line in the big book, page 95, read this book. Now there's a message, read this book. So have several different openings available. Like, you can mix it up. I remember I went to speak in British Columbia, and I was going to tell the addict in the hole story. And the guy who introduced me as the speaker preempted me, and he told the story. So I thought, oh my God, you know, I can't open with that story. It was just told. So if I did not have a number of different openings, I would have been kind of discombobulated or derailed at this moment. Well, now how do I open? But because I have a number of ways to open my share, I was able to open it up in another way. You know, another great quote, especially if I'm delivering a share on step four, I'll open with page 125. Most alcoholics, most addicts are sensitive people, and it takes a long time to overcome this serious handicap. And that's a great way to open up with a big book quote when I'm talking about step four and five and doing inventory and confessing character defects. So depending on what you're sharing and how, you know, the subject matter, there's a lot of different ways you can open up with how you want to grab them. You want to grab them right at the beginning, right? Now, what we used to be like, how should we tell our war story? Once again, our big book is very specific on how we do this. Number one, we tell the newcomers enough about our drinking, using, or acting out habits, symptoms, and experiences, encourage them to speak to themselves. So, you know, I'm going to share some stuff with them. They're going to share some stuff with me. We're going to identify. I'm like you. You're like me. Tell them how baffled you were, how you finally learned you were sick. There's a point in our stories. Do you remember the point in your story when you realized there was something different about you, something different about the way you drink, use, or act out? That's a significant benchmark in our story. You want to share that because they're going to be sharing something similar back with you. Oh, I remember my particular moment when I learned I was sick, right? Give them an account of the struggles you made. So it's not about how I drank or how much I drank or used or acted out. It's about all the different ways I tried to stop, curtail, or manage my addictive pattern that failed me. And those strategies that we do are universal. All addicts pretty much use the same strategies that fail to keep them in check. And that's another point of identifying with one another. And then show the newcomer how the mental twist, how our minds lie to us every time, which leads to that first drink, drug, act of the spree. I always say the liar always wins the argument. And every addict gets that when I share that. So you want to identify with your prospect. You know, so often I hear people share, they try to identify by saying, I prostituted myself, I lived on the streets, I've been to jail. I've never done those things. So when I hear people identify that way, there's a disconnect. There's a disconnect in me as an addict. That's not me. I didn't do that. I'm an intravenous user. When I do cocaine, I like a needle. Now, if I'm working with a marijuana addict and I'm explaining how I do up my rig, are they going to be able to identify? They're going to look at me like I got three bloody heads on. There's a disconnect. You know, as an alcoholic, I drink every day, bourbon. That's my drink. Now, I've worked with alcoholics who drink wine only. I've worked with alcoholics who drink beer only. I've worked with alcoholics who are binge drinkers or weekend warriors. I've worked with blackout drunks. I've worked with blackout drunks who smoke crack cocaine, not because they're crackheads, they want to drink longer. So behavior patterns can vary a lot within a particular addiction pattern. So if we follow the big book instructions, share our habits, symptoms, and experiences, tell them when we learned we were sick, about the strategies we used that failed us, and how our mind lies to us, we're going to get a much clearer demonstration of that identification. I'm like you, you're like me. You know, just because my boss thinks I have a drinking problem because I wore a lampshade on my head at the Christmas office party doesn't make me an alcoholic. Doesn't make me a lamp either. Right. So there are ways that we go about to communicate what we were like. And this part of the presentation illustrates to the newcomer that you are armed with the facts about yourself. Now, the second part of our story is what happened. Tell them exactly what happened to you. That moment where things changed. Stress the spiritual aspect of our program freely. Describe your last bottom, that jumping off place, that turning point, that moment of clarity. Talk about how you found your sponsor. Share your experience of attending meetings and how and when you started your step work, and share about the service work that you've done. So, you know, I remember I was fishing for brown trout. I was at this beautiful man-made lake, and it's a gorgeous summer or fall day. It was October 31st, 2003. And I'm fishing for brown trout. I caught two that day, about 14, 15 inches in length. Beautiful trout. And I'm drinking cold Corona beers and I'm smoking $400 an ounce marijuana. And I'm miserable inside and out. And I thought, I don't want to live this way anymore. And so I made a resolution not to do it. And I came home and I told my wife that I'm going to go to AA and sober up. And I remember my wife literally sobbing. And I got an awful, visceral hit of how much damage I had done to my family, the ugliness of my behavior as an untreated alcoholic addict. And now, you would think that October 31st is my dry date, but it isn't. It's November 21st. Why? Because on November 20th, I got invited to the food show where they were doing beers from around the world. However, you got a sip of a beer, like in a communion cup. They had communion cups. And anyone who's been to communion, it's a tiny little cup. And the cup was only filled maybe half full at best. And I thought, well, that's not drinking. That's not going to break my sobriety. Of course, when you drink like 400 of them, it kind of has a different effect. And that's why my sobriety date is November 21st, 2003. Now, I dried out in the open, disgusting rooms of AA and some CA in the day where there was no solution, just group therapy without a therapist, Oprah Winefest, problem, problem, problem. And by 8 months, with that honest desire not to drink or use again, I was at my wit's end. I was absolutely insane. And I was sharing and vomiting all over the room, ethereally vomiting on people with anger and resentment and insanity. And I thought, if this is sobriety, I'd rather drink. And I was leaving to go drink, and a guy grabbed me, guy I knew, a hopeless alcoholic pill popper, grabbed me, fresh skinned and glowing, just like Abby Thatcher, and said, Cameron, I'm watching you die. Let me show you how to work a program. And we didn't go to another meeting. We went to a coffee shop, opened up Big Books, and he started showing me how to work steps. And I had a profound alteration to my reaction to life. And he saved my life. And since then, I've been setting up meetings, doing workshops. I've done all the positions at the group level, the area level, the world level. I've done everything but be a trustee. And now hopefully I've reached a point where I'm just kind of like an elder statesperson trying to share with the incoming generation how to work the program, how to pay it forward, carry it forward to those that still suffer. So that's my what happened story. What are we like now? So this is your bragging rights. This is where you get to share all the great things that your program has fulfilled in your life. So talk about the promises fulfilled. Talk about how your health and your family, your work and your life has changed. Share about the fellowship that you have found. Say it loud, say it proud. Brag about it, because this program really is miraculous. And then finally, your signature sign off. And again, you can sign off with a short story, an analogy, or a big book quote. When I open with the man in the hole story or the addict in the hole story, and I say there's good news and bad news, there is a way out of the hole. At the end of my share, I then go back to the person in the hole. And I says, now, the next time you hear an addict crying out for help down in that hole, what should we do? Because it only takes a few hours to learn our program and the rest of your life to practice it. We jump into the hole with them. And they look at us bewildered. Well, now we're both in the hole, but we can turn to our brothers and sisters with a wink in our eye and we can say, it's okay. I've been here before. I got a way out with more experience, strength, and hope. I got a way out to walk hand in hand with the sunlight of the spirit. I got a way out to be an intelligent agent, a spearhead of God's ever advancing creation. And I'm for that. How about you? That's typically that's my signature sign up. I'm for that. How about you? You can use analogies. You can open with another quote. And again, it's kind of like your sign off identity. And that's how I try to deliver a good message. Now, I'm just going to come back to our seventh tradition. If you found this workshop valuable and you thought, you know, there's some good stuff here, I'd really like to, you know, up my game when sharing my story, please consider going to our website and making a seventh donation of $5, $10, $20. It just offsets our Zoom costs and our website costs. And of course, all in tongue-in-cheek fashion, I have a little song to play here. Money. And then lastly, I'm looking forward to hearing you share, your talk at the next 12-step recovery meeting or convention. Now, what I offer is if any one of you would like to work on this, you're welcome to reach out to me. I'll put my phone number in the chat. I don't mind coaching someone. What I do is I set up a Zoom meeting. We get together. You present to me your story. I record it for you, both visually and auditorily. And then at the end of it, we discuss things that you could add or take away or just alter. And then you go away, you work on it. And then we have another meeting where you come back and you present your new share, and I record that also. And if you'd like that, I'm more than pleased to do that, to discuss your presentation. Do a dry run or, you know, on Zoom and re-record it, and you can learn and adapt and improve your share for the benefit of audiences who will resonate. You know, I'm like you, you're like me, you don't do it anymore. I want what you have. I want to be a member of a 12-step program, and I'm for that. How about you? God bless. Thank you so much, everyone, for joining me on this presentation.